Hello, kids! Bat Segundo here, and I must confess that I'm not much of a walker. These days, my walking is dictated by the sad walking man that replaces the red hand at a crosswalk signal. And even then, I'm not sure if this cagey signal is encouraging me to cross the street or ridiculing my paucity of physical fitness. You see, there once was a time in my youth before my drinking and my problems in talking with the female gender in which there were manic peregrinations. I would often spend long hours walking across the great flatlands, believing that I could commune with nature if I only kept up the walking and the thinking. But drinking became easier, and here I am waiting for the IRS to knock upon my hotel room door to ask me about those receipts from the liquor store. It appears our young roving correspondent faced similar problems when the issue was brought up with Will Self.
Okay, I'm here with Will Self, who is the author of Great Apes, Dorian, The Book of Dave, and most recently Psychogeography. Will, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, actually, thank you.
Oh, great. First off, I wanted to actually ask you about the connections between Psychogeography and The Book of Dave. I read both of these at the same time, and so I saw a number of things that were overlapping. For example, I couldn't help noticing certain topographical similarities. You have one column devoted to gaudy city murals, and lo and behold, in The Book of Dave, there's a moment where Michelle actually looks upon a gaudy city mural. So I wanted to actually ask you also, and also one might also argue that Carl's journey to Ham is reminiscent of one of your long walks. From Ham, rather. And I wanted to actually ask you in terms of how the column may have helped you overlap some of your ideas with the fictional ones that you were exploring.
I can't remember the gaudy in Dave at all. It's funny, people immediately see or recall things that you've forgotten. I mean, I think it's fair game as somebody who writes a fair amount of journalism to recycle fiction into journalism in terms of tropes and imagery, but I never do the other way around. I never usually coin anything on the page in journalism that I then use in fiction because it's already been in currency. You know, a limited number of people read my books, but many more people tend to read my newspaper work. So that's the way around it works in order to be fair to the readership. Though some might argue that you should never. I know Nicholson Baker lines his books up and checks them line by line for any repetition, even of sort of, you know, adjective-noun combinations. Perhaps that's why he hasn't published much recently.
Well, he's got a big 800-page tract coming in February, yeah. So
well,
he's been busy, yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about Nicholson Baker because I've been, you know, traveling through North America for the last couple of weeks with no luggage. It's an exercise in focusing on the material world. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about his book, The Mezzanine, and about the kind of, I admire his work a lot. But in answer to your question, yeah, the topographical obsession, the obsession with London, in Dave, you have a London flooded. And of course, you have a protagonist who has perhaps the most exhaustive possible knowledge of a city, a licensed London cab driver who has to learn the names of every single street and every notable building within a six-mile radius of Charing Cross in the centre of London. So that's a phenomenal topographic obsession to start with. But yeah, I think the way that Psychogeography impinged on the Book of Dave was in that it is my most rooted book in place. I mean, I've always been a writer of place to some extent. You know, I always remember that Nabokov, when he gave his lectures on literature at Cornell in the 50s, would draw a floor plan of Mansfield Park if he was lecturing on Austin, or draw Proust's Two Ways at Combray if he was lecturing on A la Recherche. So I've always had that sort of underlying my books, I think. But in Dave, I think it does come to the fore.
And in fact, I was actually going to ask you about that, because I know in your Martin Amis profile, you cited that particular rule he had about topographical necessity in order to carry on a novel. I wanted to find out if it was, you feel that it is impossible to write a book without this locative specificity.
I think it's impossible. I mean, I think people do it in pairings. I always remember being in Brazil years ago and John Updike had been in Brazil the year before and been there for sort of 5 or 6 days and written a novel called Brazil, with a certain amount of chutzpah, you might argue. The Brazilians, of course, were very damning about it and sort of said, oh, he didn't understand the society at all. But people do that, don't they?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm writing a long short story, short novella at the moment set in Zurich. And I've only been in Zurich for 24 hours in my life. But I find that a tough call, actually. It's not about Zurich. I wouldn't presume to write about Zurich with 24 hours acquaintance. I do like a topographic specificity, yes, I do.
Well, there's also something vaguely psychogeographic about your setup. I know you actually write with post-it notes in your room depicting the plot of the novel that you're working on. And it seems to me that that kind of structural approach would be of some psychogeographic scope.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of... Montaigne used to carve his aphorisms and ideas into the beams of his library. I mean, I think that idea of kind of being within a sort of synecdoche, in a way, you know, or being within a kind of model of the virtuality of a book is very appealing to me. I mean, there are pictures on my website of the room, but in fact, it's a lot shaggier with post-it notes than them when they were taken. I mean, you know, it's an organic thing because the post-it notes go up onto the walls and it is covered in them.
Yeah.
And then they come down and go into kind of scrapbooks that I then work from, and then new post-it notes go up. So it's a kind of organism. It's a post-it note ecosystem.
Why do post-it notes work more than 3x5 cards or, say, an outline that you can actually scribble upon?
I did used to have 3x5 file cards. I like a 3x5 file cards. I used to have one of those rotating wire racks that people use for selling postcards that I put my 3x5 cards in. So I've tried that. Really, towards the end of my marijuana smoking years, my short-term memory had got so bad that I needed something to be continually presented to me. It was a memory problem, and I had very bad short-term memory. That's improved now, and I can work with notes that aren't immediately in front of me in that way. But I find it, you know, you sit in that room in a swivel chair, and you look around, and the room is loosely divided into different projects and metaphors, tropes, points of information, character ideas, descriptive ideas. So anywhere I look in the room, something will come at me. And, you know, a lot of art is the juxtaposition of apparently irreconcilable ideas. And there you are in a kind of machine for generating fiction just by looking at these post-it notes.
Gotcha. Language, too. I mean, I actually have to ask you about this if we're going to talk. I mean, you open up a Will Self book and you see words like hypogean or minatory used in great frequency. You're constantly sort of rushing for the unabridged. Do you feel that language is a way to kind of get the reader sort of thinking in psychogeographic terms, in terms of throwing them off from the comfortable reality of what a novel should be?
I don't know. I mean, I think, when I wrote My Idea of Fun years ago, when I was a stripling, I had a character, the Fat Controller, who was a kind of rampant sesquipedalian and was, you know, obsessed by neologisms and coinages and, you know, recondite terms. And maybe that was an expression of that part of myself. I mean, some of my stuff's actually pretty straightforward. It just depends on what the mot juste is. I don't think I'm a kind of wanton in that way, though many people often charge me with it. I don't collect words in any kind of obsessive way. I mean, I work with a, you know, good old-fashioned analog Oxford English Dictionary, and if I look up a word, as a writer frequently must, and I see an interesting word next to it, I'll note it down. But I never go truffling for words. It's just, I've always sort of, I think there are some writers who work with a limited vocabulary and do interesting things with it. But, you know, so what? I mean, we have this phenomenal language, English. This incredible, you know, there is no other European language that has as big a vocabulary except for Russian, actually. And I don't know, it's like that Peter Carey story, The Cartographers, where, you know, they stop mapping bits of the country and it ceases to exist. And I kind of slightly feel that way about English, that it needs to be given a little workout.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, you know, it's not a strongly willed part of my writing for me at all.
Gotcha. But why use minatory instead of menacing?
Well, or threatening might be closer. Yeah. I think it suggests the Hypogean. You know, it suggests, because of the association with the Minotaur, it suggests a certain kind of menace or threat. You know, it has an overtone, it has a kind of, it has a penumbra to it as a word that, that I don't think menacing or threatening necessarily has.
Is this also why you often have lexical blending coinage in your work? Like in psychogeography, I observed many kidults, for example.
Kidults, yeah, I love that term. Yeah. I think it's so apt for the contemporary world, which is a kind of kidult world, isn't it? I like coinage as well. If it can, I haven't come up with any startling ones recently, except that, you know, I think that the greater Los Angeles area, it should be described as the Fatlands, but they come and go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is this your effort to sort of, I guess, make a mark, to sort of enter the lingua franca with hopeful coinages that other people have used? Have you, do you know other people who have used kidult?
Oh, I didn't think it was my coinage.
Yeah.
I don't think it is my coinage at all. I'm not sure whose it is, but I don't think it's mine. It might be. I don't know. No, I've got no ambitions at that level at all. I've never consciously thought about it, to be honest. It's just what works for me on the page.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a term that works. I mean, you know, I just think a writer is like a painter with his palette. You know, you're mixing up things and you're squeezing out tubes and you're looking for something that works harmoniously for you.
Yeah, gotcha. I actually wanted to ask you, because I read in the Telegraph interview that you are devoted to writing 1,000 words a day. You also use language, as we're talking about, very much like an author, Anthony Burgess, who also subscribed very much to this principle of writing 1,000 words a day. So I have to ask, is Burgess an influence for you? Or?
Yes and no. I mean, I think he's a rather fabulous monster, isn't he?
Yeah. You've read his biography, the two-volume.
Marvelous in many
fantastic
ways.
Fantastic pack of lies, you know?
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, there are certainly major embellishments. There was then a kind of biography that was, would be termed in the 18th century, a flighting of
yeah.
him, saying that it was all a pack of lies. And there has been another biography somewhat correcting the view that it's a pack of lies.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I think the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. I don't know. Burgess is a very particular kind of figure. A lot of his work's unreadable is his problem, I think, as a writer, which is a major problem for a writer, is to be unreadable. And at that level, I don't really want to be like him at all.
Which volumes do you consider unreadable?
Things like Napoleon Symphony, some of the experimental stuff is really... You know, it's very hard work to get through, and has dated a lot. But I mean, that's fine. I mean, I'm not necessarily comparing myself favorably necessarily to Burgess. I don't know how people would place me in relation to him. But he's not one of the writers that showed me the way, if you like. No.
Well, who were the writers who showed you the way?
Bulgakov, Kafka, Borges, Heller's Catch 22, Swift. Ballard, Burroughs to some extent, and the whole pantheon of literature. I mean, you know, I think I was reading I'm reading tonight with some guy at the 92nd Street Y, his name, of course, I've managed to forget, but has written this book called This Is the Last Novel. That's a kind of
David Markson.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful writer. Yeah.
Right, but it's like a collection of aphorisms. This book. I mean, that's all it is.
Yeah.
I mean.
Have you read it?
Yeah, I read about half of it on the plane.
Okay.
But one of the aphorisms is, and I can't remember whose it is. Is you know all you know what you need to be a writer is to read 1,500 books, and I would subscribe to that. So, you know, I mean, the influences are as numerous as the books.
I ask about the Burgess reference also because of the glossary in the Book of Dave of this interesting Mockney. And also, there's even a... It actually reminded me more of The Wanting Seed, more so than A Clockwork Orange, in addition to having the, you know, sort of glossary in the sense that there's the whole cannibalism, there's this sort of wasteland. That's why I kind of asked the question if it was actually... a influence to some extent on the Book of Day.
NASDAQ, it really is far more influenced by Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker, which, you know, is, I think, runs rings around the Clockwork Orange linguistically, and certainly around the Book of Dave as well. I mean, I had a failure of nerve with the Book of Dave. I mean, really, the future sections should have been written entirely in Mockney, in my view. But I mean, in fact, just saying it makes me slightly ashamed. I mean, Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker is a post-nuclear apocalyptic book written entirely in a deteriorated English, and it's beautiful. It's beautifully done, beautifully carried out. I mean, Hoban wrote an afterword to the novel in which he explained how he put the language together, or rather broke the language up, that makes it much more accessible for a reader. But, you know, if anybody's listening who has the urge to try it, try Ridley Walker. I mean, it is a haunting and beautiful thing, and the fact that it's written in this broken down and, to be frank, far more innovative deteriorated English than mine. I mean, my Mockney is just transliterated Cockney. I mean, it really isn't, it's not an invented language at all. It's just a phonetic rendition of an existing dialect.
Gotcha. Well, I also wanted to ask you about this because the Mockney starts to decrease the more you go into these futuristic chapters over the course of the book. And I was wondering if that represented a certain fatigue on your end in the course of writing.
Well, I mean, there is a courtly dialect spoken with RP, which is, you know, more like modern English. It is modern English. No, I thought that was legitimate, that you know, to have these two dialects. I mean, it's unreasonable to expect that everybody in a society, I mean, they're at about a 16th century level of development. Printing is just coming in, and of course, printing standardizes orthography and thereby standardizes pronunciation. So, you know, the hamsters, the people on this remote island, you know, they are speaking a very, very heavy post-London Cockney dialect, but the people in New London are speaking a kind of courtly speech. I thought that was legitimate. And of course, the Mockney starts, or at any rate, the orthographic Mockney starts to make itself felt in the present towards the end of the book. So it kind of migrates back into the present.
Even phrases like, I want your sex, it sort of shows up in the future, and then you read it in the present and you start to realize just what is going on here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's in order to encourage the perception of linkage. I mean, you know, the moment I was on a panel with a sci-fi writer in Chicago yesterday who was talking about, you know, one of the delights of writing futuristic writing of any kind is the shock of recognition and the sense of deep time that writing future stuff enables. And I expect, you know, it's the only genre that can convey that sense of deep time, really, effectively. I don't think writing about the past actually does it, because you cannot interpolate the present into the past. You know, it's much harder to do that. I suppose you can do it if you do it well, but interestingly, few people decide to write about the deep past and then the present. But we're all looking for that kind of moment when Charlton Heston, you know, finds the Statue of Liberty at the end of Planet of the Apes, which is a great movie moment. And we're looking for that kind of, to reproduce that frisson of kind of recognition in those sort of fictions.
I actually wanted to ask you and sort of delve into the whole psychogeography of this, of the latest volume. But dwelling upon the fiction before we get into that, I wanted to actually ask you not just about the psychogeographical nature of your fiction, but also the fact that there's sort of this vaguely biological nature, in the sense of Dave, for example, has the whole hair transplant fiasco. And then also, if we're going to Great Apes, we have Dykes convinced that he is human. So it's almost as if it's not just necessarily an internal nature of not knowing one's coordinates, but there's also something biological or external about this. I was wondering if you can talk to you about any relationship you're aware of, or that you have perhaps contemplated during the course of writing this stuff.
Well, I think it used to be said that there was a certain kind of callow male, specifically English writer, who was rather preoccupied by bodily functions and by a kind of gross corporeality that other kind of tonier writers didn't kind of go. I mean, I never really understood that argument, or, you know, I think it's kind of bullshit. I mean, you know, the body is where everything starts and it's where everything goes, and, you know, those critics who find my work kind of grotesquely corporeal should go back to Swift if they really want to see what grotesquely corporeal writing is like, because I'm not a patch on that.
It's the Ballard influence.
Well, Ballard is interested in the body, certainly. He's in some ways a more poetic writer about the body than I am, and there is a sense of the bodies in his books as oddly less than the sum of their parts. I don't think that he's so preoccupied with the minutiae of physicality as I am, but I think, you know, I've often wondered about that. I think there's two. The kind of more elevated side of it is, you know, it's all mixed up for me. I mean, at one level, I think that the body is where we begin, and the there's a duty to report it honestly and faithfully, this kind of discourse that we have with our bodies that is actually very intimate and, you know, we don't really want to talk about. I think there's a duty to report that as a writer. I also think it's one of the few certainties that we have. One of the few, you know, it's like people say, well, you know, how do you write a female character? You imagine you have a vagina and breasts and you have periods. That's how I go about it. You know,
you did it quite literally with cock and bull, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't start thinking, well, how would a woman think about this? I start with what a woman's body would be like in that context and move on from it. But I also think, you know, I mean, referring to Swift again, that there is a sense in which, you know, civilization is discontents, as Freud would put it. You know, a lot of civilization is concerned with banishing the body. And, you know, as a satiric device, the best thing you can do to deconstruct civilization is to put the body back in and say, look, you know, this is about, micturating, evacuating, pullulating, you know, hosts of virus type creatures with parasites in their bowels. You know, this is, you want to get that back in, and then you can start to work on exposing society for what it is. It's a very animalistic thing.
When you come up with a character, does it start in some sense with the body?
It certainly starts with a physical type, of some sort. I mean, it's kind of like the topography in that, you know, I think a reader knows if a writer knows what he's writing about, if you see what I mean, without the writer necessarily detailing it. You know Joyce really knew Dublin, though he hadn't lived there for a number of years. You really know, and he wrote with a street plan in his mind. It's important for that book to work, even though, you know, the reader may never have been to Dublin. And by the same criterion, it's important that a writer know what his characters, the physicality of his characters is.
Gotcha. Let's go ahead and jump into some of the essays in psychogeography. You quibble with English historian Oliver Rackham in Fantastic Mr. Fox, noting that his agenda involved observing the state of the country and nature from his window.
And yet, it's said of him.
Anyway, but also in Newfoundland, you actually sort of look through your mother's diary in that. So I'm wondering, to what degree is psychogeography applicable if it is something that is essentially observed without migration?
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it's a practice, psychogeography. I mean, you know, those pieces, the newspaper column under the heading psychogeography are really very loosely bracketed under that heading. I mean, I think that the signature essay, Walking to New York, is probably, as I state within it, the kind of clearest exposition of what I'm actually about in psychogeographic terms. And the kind of project of airport walks is much more closer to my brand of psychogeography. Many of the pieces in the book are, you know, they're feuilletons, they're kind of they're little kind of diversions often, but many of them, like that Rackham, the piece that mentions Oliver Rackham, splendid writer, by the way, his History of the English Countryside is a must, really. A must buy. Opera should be promoting it heavily. Do address this kind of conundrum. You know, I mean, this the piece about Newfoundland that you mentioned, where I really didn't know that I'd been on a ship to the States, to Canada, when I was a two-year-old child. And it is bizarre to read about yourself in some detail as a two-year-old child in these places that, of course, you have no recollection being. You know, that is a kind of conundrum of space and time in itself, you know, and all sorts of representations of place and psyche, I think, are allowable under this very loose practice of psychogeography, which isn't, it's not a field.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a faculty. There are no kind of academics in it. It's a practice that, that marches through like a narrative line, environmentalism, ecology, the built environment, architecture, aspects of philosophy, naturalism, so on and so forth. You know, so anything's kind of legitimate in its furtherance.
Interesting, because I mean, was actually a review of this book in the LA Times book review in which this thing that we're talking about psychogeography being a very austere practice as opposed to a loose practice, Carrie Higgins actually wrote, and she said that your walks do not fit into the explicit drifting parameters set down by Guy Debord, and she pointed out that you never reflected upon your most dramatic deviation from the Situationists, which she described as the tendency to head directly for a tourist attraction, such as the John Hancock Center and the Trevi Fountain, things like that. But I wanted to sort of ask you.
Was it a critical review?
This was a critical, well, it was critical on this particular idea.
Was it critical overall?
Well, it was sort of, I guess, overall it was favorable. But the whole idea of going to a major landmark as opposed to sort of shifting into this kind of complete overhaul of perception. Why did you go then to, you know, the sort of the obvious place on some of these walks in these columns?
I had my kids with me.
Ah, okay.
I mean, you know, I don't have, you know, you can look at my, these are occasional newspaper columns. I don't dedicate my life to traveling around the world in an unusual way. You know, I've written 17 other books. I mean, I simply wouldn't have time to do that.
Gotcha.
You know, I'm not saying they're kind of shavings from a writer's table, but they're more like that than they are. And they don't profess to be anything else, really. I mean, the longer essay, Walking to New York, I'm kind of prouder of as a statement of, you know, what some of my aims are as a walker. And I'm doing another long book of three essays that cover that kind of territory.
Oh, okay.
But the actual newspaper column is, it's an incidental series in that way. So, you know, that's why I go to the Trevi Fountain and, you know, Sagria Familia and things like that. You know, I mean, left to my own devices, I wouldn't go anywhere near them, but I've normally got, you know, one or two or three or four children in tow, so, you know.
So the Situationists for you are just a starting point.
The Situationists are people without kids.
Gotcha.
You know, it's like you never saw Sartre and de Beauvoir pushing a baby buggy outside the Café de Margot. I mean, it's, you know, actually that's not a non-trivial point. You know, this is, you know, Debord didn't have children.
Yeah.
I mean, he probably wouldn't have been able to dérive quite as much if he did.
Yeah. I wanted to actually ask you about this notion of citizenship, which we actually discussed in the lobby. In Apples or Pears, you note this phenomenon of being a dual citizen. I saw your passports that you showed to the desk, and you didn't know whether you were American, British, or European. I'm wondering if you feel, after many of these psychogeography columns, that you have settled this question more, or are you still a banana skin glistening through immigration these days?
Glissading.
Glissading, I'm sorry. Yeah, my apologies.
I'm a Londoner, fundamentally. The big cities now, London, it's just become the financial capital of the world in the last year, which is cut off always during periods of economic boom from the hinterland of England. It, you know, it's a part of the global economy. It's a financial capital primarily. It's like a medieval city-state in that regard. So, you know, I'm principally a citizen of London. Certainly not of Britain, which is a very artificial construct increasingly. Certainly not of the States. I don't live here. You know, I feel at home here a bit more than I would if I hadn't had an American mother. I didn't have an American half-brother. You know, I didn't have strong links here, but I don't in any real sense. I feel American enough to dislike the knee-jerk anti-Americanism of Europeans, which I think is all too easily falls into a sloppy hatred of Americans instead of a quite, you know, reasonable distrust of the American military-industrial complex. So, you know, I feel American to that extent, you know, just as I feel Jewish enough to kind of feel angry at anti-Semitism when it's casually expressed. But, you know, that, no, I'm a Londoner, first and foremost. And, you know, the more Dave was really a book that was a kind of very profound book for me in terms of identity. I mean, it, up until that point, really right through the late 80s, and you know, I moved out of London in I didn't move far, but I tried to get out of the city from 1990 to 95. And even when I came back to the city after 5 years, not that I didn't come into town every week, but I was living in the kind of hinterland. You know, it took until I wrote Dave, really, another near decade before I became fully reconciled to London. You know, before my very powerful ambivalence around it, my inability to leave, and my kind of hatred of it, really, hatred of everything that that kind of degree of urbanity represents. You know, but in the writing of Dave, I came out of Dave really rather loving London and being comfortable with my identity.
I'm wondering if national identity has much to do with some of these peregrinations of yours, or even just dwelling upon the idea of psychogeography.
No, none at all for me. I mean, I don't think it's... For me, psychogeography is about the urban and the rural and the suburban. Yes, it's about alternate cultures, and it's about the way that cultures, different cultures, perceive those categories. It's not really about the cultures themselves in that way, which are often very unknowable. I mean, I'm just a carpetbagger. I move through societies. I don't really, you know, there's a few pieces in the book that are about that kind of deep level of kind of cultural misreading that we're involved in the whole time. I'm not a traveler, a professional traveler. I think a lot of professional travel writing is pornography for, you know, it's wank fodder for people who sit in armchairs, or it's for people who are in thrall. I mean, the woman in the LA Times may have criticized me for going to the Trevi Fountain, but I'm sure I didn't describe it as a travel writer would describe it, or as a, you know, somebody, and nor am I interested in the picturesque per se, even if I have to take my kids to see it. I mean, I'm not involved in that kind of you know, really the whole kind of travel industry is geared to a kind of debased romanticism, a kind of search for the picturesque. And I dissent strongly from that.
Mm. Interesting. I wanted to actually ask you about your observation in Madame Jacquard of giving up cigarettes, and how cigarettes form this necessary unit to get from one place to another, and how it's part of this linear narrative translated into a series of perplexing jump cuts. You're down to three now, so I'm wondering if... Speaking now, you have any kind of linear narrative now of these three, or what?
No, three is not enough for a narrative. I mean, it would be it's concision. They would be like haikus, you know, sort of scattered. I mean, it's just not enough cigarettes to provide a narrative anymore.
You
need the constant ebb and flow of nicotine in your system to provide that. It's not working for me anymore, I'm afraid. I've lost the cigarette narrative.
Yeah, well, you have basically the walking narrative, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe the walking narrative is there more strongly as a result. I've had some absolutely splendid walks during this trip. It's been very exciting for me. They've been, the airport walks have been great. But perhaps the best walk was, I mean, I walked in from Pearson to Toronto. I walked in from SeaTac to Seattle. Big walks, 16, 17-mile walks. Had a good long walk in San Francisco out from Castro out to Sausalito over the Golden Gate Bridge. I had a beautiful walk where I arrived at O'Hare and then kind of got off the subway. The first stop, at, I think it's called Rosemont, and within 20 minutes of leaving the aircraft, I was face to face with a deer in a wood by a river. In this totally underimagined place, you know, it's a classic interzone, classic liminal place, and then found myself actually walking through the wood directly under the flight path. So I had this kind of juxtaposition of what I think of as the modern sublime, the kind of, you know, jet travel is the strangest, fascinating, most awe-inspiring physical experience that most of us will have in our lifetime, that's mediated by human society in that way. And yet everything about international air travel is arranged to make it dull and vacuous and boring. And yet, you know, the airport walk recovers the sublime aspect of air travel in that way. And then, you know, yesterday in Chicago, I walked to Walmart which is another kind of walk, another sort of biopsy of the urban environment. I mean, I think, you know, where I do differ from Debord is that, you know, of course, I don't believe that the act of a dérive is, I mean, you know, I don't know what the LA Times critic thinks about it, but, you know, on the Debordian premise, a dérive should destroy the society of the spectacle, you know. Yeah. You know, when Debord was writing, Marxists still spoke quite fervently about late capitalism, you know, but, you know, how late it is. And it's here, it's later and stronger than ever. So, you know, I don't have that kind of, you know, and indeed, I think that the kind of Marxian conception of what these sort of acts might be involved in is ridiculous and moonshine. But I do think there's a different kind of insurgency involved in long distance kind of walking in this way. And I think that, you know, I confess I almost always have a purpose, even if it's not a trivial purpose. The classic dérive has to be purposeless by definition, but mine, you know, I normally have something I've got to do. Yeah. And I think that's more valid in a way, because it's more subversive of other systems of travel and the way in which the kind of man-machine matrix kind of, for, you know, cuts and dices time and space.
Is a kilometer a suitable replacement for the cigarette in terms of units?
I think in miles. I'm quite old-fashioned. Okay. I think in either, actually. I lived in Australia for a while, and I got kilometers too. I think in both. The big walks, long, you know, I like a high mileage in a day if I can do it, on the walk, not so much the urban walks, but the ex-urban walks, the walks in and out of cities. And if I can walk 25, 30, even 35 miles in a day, then that is a very, very strong narrative, because, you know, that's the point at which you start, the mind starts to be conscious of landforms more than it is of human geography. That's the point. That's what it takes for us to forget about the environment as being the built environment and the humanized world, and even in highly densely populated Western societies, to start thinking about river valleys and massifs.
Since you've been doing so many of these narratives, we'll refer to them as that, I'm wondering if you're now starting to sort of see an overlapping of narratives, if there is something of the mystery of these journeys being lost over the course of long walks like these, the same kind of details that you take in from a different vantage point.
Explain yourself a bit more. I'm not sure I'm following you.
I'm just wondering, you're walking from airports often, so yeah. Inevitably you're going to sort of see the same kind of drab land.
No, they're all different. They're all very different. I mean, you know, they're radically different. That's why I was saying to you down in the lobby, you know, you were sort of saying, well, I must walk more. But, you know, that's like somebody saying, oh, I'm, you know, try and get out of that chair. I mean, you can start now. You know, what's holding you back is that anxiety. It's, you know, what it really is that you think you'll be bored. Mm. Your ceaseless quest for diversion and the picturesque is what terrifies you of these walks. It's not, you know, you know your legs will carry you there. You know that your intellect will be able to sort out the orientation.
Well, it's actually just, I just need a day to do this, really, you know.
Well, you do and you don't.
Yeah.
You know, you've got things to do. You could reasonably walk between them. Yeah, it is a time factor in a time-pressured world, but, you know, there's probably a way you could factor it in. I'd put it to you that your real anxiety about it is that you think you're going to be bored. I mean, and that question betrays that. You know, aren't you seeing all the same sorts of things? And I'm saying to you, no, I'm seeing some radically different things.
I'm not suggesting that they're each going to be the same, but I'm wondering if, like reading multiple narratives, you're going to encounter similar plot points, similar sorts of things, the whole notion of having a kind of new geography develop upon the brain, and therefore you're kind of going to say, well, here are certain details like that. I guess maybe I am probably constantly looking for the quest for the new, which would make sense, but I'm wondering, have you sort of started to see any commonalities, or have they always been distinct, these particular experiences for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big difference whether you're walking with somebody, with a companion or not. Because the minute you're walking with somebody, you're involved in a very different kind of narrative. You're involved in, you know, walking with somebody is a very intimate act, actually. it's about as intimate as you know, it's more intimate than sex in some ways. And some of these walks, you know, on this suite through North America, I've done them with people. People have come to interview me, or we come to talk about walking. So that's very different. Somebody you don't know, so you're getting to know somebody in this kind of context. So that's a big difference automatically. When you're alone and you do this, you know, what you're mapping onto the territory is your own emotional and psychic states. And they're constantly changing. I mean, you know, the you have to encounter the sort of pathetic fallacy of psychogeography. You know, does this place, this you know, abandoned used car lot feel particularly minatory because I'm in a bad mood or my digestion is screwed up, or is it genuinely more threatening? You know, you have to, I find the narratives associated these you know, narrative walks to be very various, yeah, very various. I mean, and I think the way they become various is by you know, being genuinely open to them. It's a Zen pursuit in that way. It's not predetermined, because you're not in search of the picturesque at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, you set out with no hope of the picturesque. It's fascinating to see the way it creeps back in and how you start to find things beautiful that you never thought you would. So it's a very, very powerful narrative of reclamation for me, subversion and reclamation.
So really it's a matter of, I guess, expanding one's curiosity then, or expanding one's perception. That's essentially what it boils down to.
Yes, but I think, you know, I'm quite solipsistic and quite like a lot of novelists and quite bound up in my own mind. And I find it difficult talking to people, really. I mean, it's a big thing for me, you know. I kind of... But even so, even though I may not talk to an awful lot of people as I go along, there is a strange kind of association with people's lives that, you know, that by visiting places and moving through places that you wouldn't choose to visit for human reasons, you curiously are connected with the human in a way, because you're within other people's environment, within other people's psychogeography in that way. It's,
so in taking in a system that is often devoid of people, you essentially learn more about people, you're saying?
Yes, I would argue that, yeah. You do in an odd way.
Well, Will, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure chatting to you.